The First Amendment is sort of a how-to, you know, and it creates boundaries and lack of boundaries for our way to speak. It is not a moral compass. It does not tell us how to act civilly. It does not tell us to act morally. We have to infuse that into the First Amendment, and particularly at this time right now, thinking about the fact that constitutional speech is bounded, it's sort of boundless. Moral speech is not. Moral speech is much, much smaller. If we can sort of infuse our constitution, the concept of constitutionality with morality in our heads, not necessarily legally, because I don't think that that's appropriate, but to infuse morality into our speech, that's what I would like to see. And that's what I would like to be the moral of the story.
Hi. I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hello, my name is Lynn Greenkey. I am Professor Emeritus at Syracuse University in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department and the author of When Freedom Speaks, The Boundaries and the Boundlessness of Our First Amendment Right. And welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Lynn, thank you so much for being here with me today. And the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. Something we haven't heard a lot about in the news lately over the last few years. Yes. But we're going to get into some of the weeds of it because there's so many misrepresentations of it. Everyone thinks that anything they say comes out of their mouth or rights or whatever. It's what they're, you know, it's their right to do all of that. But I want to read something that you wrote in one of your essays recently. I think it was back in August or September. The First Amendment is the single strongest protection we have against controlled thought and speech. It principally protects the development and exchange of information, opinions, and beliefs through an open market of ideas. What do you mean by an open market of ideas?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Open marketplace of ideas. It was a concept that was developed in a Supreme Court case by Justice Holmes. And the concept is really, you can analogize it to a commercial marketplace, that you have products in the marketplace that they compete against one another, and supposedly the best products win out. Of course, sometimes there are products in the marketplace that are not the best and that are harmful. And in those situations, the government's going to step in sometimes and affect the marketplace, pull the products out or insist on warnings on the products, such as perhaps cigarettes. The marketplace of ideas is very similar. Our hope is that we have ideas that come into the marketplace, true and false, disinformation, misinformation, data that works and is important, and that ultimately through debate and discussion, sometimes they can be sort of angry debate and discussion, but through debate and discussion, the truth will out. That's all nice, right? It's nice in a fairy tale. It doesn't always happen that way, right? And there are some times that the government has to step in once again and say, you know, there are certain types of speech that need to be regulated or eliminated or criminalized, and those are the types of speech that are not allowed in the marketplace of ideas, and that the government can, and remember, it's the government, right, can then affect that sort of speech.
Okay, so we just mentioned the word government. Can you go back to what is the history of the right for speech, of the First Amendment? Where does it come from, and what do you think was the reason for it becoming the First Amendment?
That it's a long history, and thank you for that question, because one of the things that I found while I was teaching is our civics education in the United States is awful. our students just don't know anything. And when I would start introducing things, I would say to them, I'd start out by saying, it's not your fault. You don't know the answer to this and it's not your fault, but let's not have you graduate from university without knowing these things. So what is the history? We have the Constitution. The Constitution was a document which initially did not have any amendments to it. The first 10 amendments are the Bill of Rights. While the Constitution was being developed, there was this debate between the anti-federalists and the federalists. And that was about how strong the federal government should be vis-a-vis the states. Who should have more power, the states or the federal government? We see that today all the time, right? Particularly in the abortion debate, and sometimes in the gun rights debates. You know, who should have the power? That's the whole Roe versus Wade thing, right? Dobbs came down and said, "We're going to take the constitutional right to an abortion out of the federal area, and we're going to give it back to the states." Of course, that's being turned around a little bit, but that's a story for another time. But that's the state versus federal government. Which should be stronger, the feds or the state? That's a federalist, anti-federalist debate. And the Constitution was ratified, but with the proviso that there was going to be a Bill of Rights that was going to be attached to it. Now, of course, the Federalists were opposed to it because the reason was that they didn't want to have a list of things that maybe that could actually undermine the power of the federal government. And the states wanted it because they wanted to say, hey, look, federal government, you can do this. You have the power to this and you don't have the power to do that. An aside, which I always thought was very interesting and I needed to tell my students, the government has power. The people have rights. It's not about the right of the government. It's about the power of the government. So ultimately, after the Constitution was ratified, came the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment wasn't the First Amendment when the debate started. It was actually the third. Finally, it got whittled down to three amendments. The First Amendment having five rights to it. And one of the most interesting things about that is that the first clause in the First Amendment isn't our freedom of speech, it's our freedom of religion, the exercise and the establishment clauses. So, if placement in a sentence is important, religion came before speech. So that's also sort of a debate that's ongoing today. But that's the short history of the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, really short.
Well, it's a podcast, so if we went in for hours, people would tune out. But what's amazing is the fact that religion is the first, and as you said, placement, word placement matters, just like words matter. So when we're talking about freedom of speech, are we just talking about the spoken word, the written word, and now I don't even know what you call it, the posting word? What are we talking about?
It's really about expression. Not really about speech. It's about expression. We all know that we can speak in many ways. We can speak in art. We can speak in song. We can speak in silence. We can speak by what we're wearing. There's a fabulous case in the book about this young man who was protesting the Vietnam War who wore a jean jacket with F the draft on it, was ultimately arrested. And the Supreme Court found that he was exhibiting freedom of speech. It was symbolic speech with the speech on his jacket. One of the things I love about that case, it was introduced to me by my wonderful professor at Northwestern University, Franklin Heyman, and the way he talked about it was that particular case gave First Amendment protection to the language of the streets. So it can be any kind of language. It can be ugly language. It can be offensive language, angry language. But it's about expression. It doesn't necessarily have to be about speech.
Okay. And you mentioned that particular case. And that was back in the 60s, I believe, at the same time, because he was coming in to testify. A young man with the last name O'Brien had been arrested for burning his draft card. And some people listening to this might not realize that back in the 60s, there was a draft. It was the Vietnam War. And there were a lot of people who were against the war. And so can you give us a little bit, because we've had, as I said, O'Brien back in the 60s burned his draft card. His friend came in with a jacket that said F the draft. How are those two things either similar or not?
There's even a, I will talk about that, and I'll talk about your third case about burning the flag. So burning the draft card, there was a law, there was a federal law that says it is a criminal offense to burn a draft card. And the Congress had said that the reason that the law is there is because we need to be able to maintain our army. So you can't burn the draft card. What O'Brien and many of his colleagues did was they took their draft card anyway, and they burned it. And they burned it as an expression of opposition to the draft and to the draft in particular, the Vietnam War in general. They were arrested. And it was finally the court said, no, even though it was your intent to communicate, you can't take a criminal act and then transform it into a protected speech act just because you want to. It was criminal to burn your draft card, and the government had a compelling reason, maintaining the army, to criminalize that event. And it was really narrowly and the legislation was narrowly tailored to that particular compelling interest of the government. The government wanted to maintain an army, and they said, look, you just can't burn your draft card. You can burn a piece of paper, another piece of paper. It could have been a copy of a draft card, but you can't burn your draft card. So that was criminal. I'm going to switch to the flag burning because that's actually a little bit of a better comparison. There's this other guy, Johnson, back in the 80s during the Reagan administration, who decided he didn't like the Reagan administration, and during the re-election campaign was during the Republican convention that time, which I believe was down in Dallas. He decided to burn a flag. It was also against the law, and this was in state law, but it was against the law in Texas to burn a flag for the purpose of protest. You could burn a flag if you were burying the flag in with respect, but not for the purpose of protest. So, both criminal acts, but the law in Texas was targeted at the expressive event. Whereas the law on the draft card was targeted at maintaining the military, the law in Texas was targeted at the expressive event. That's called content-based. And the government can't say, we don't like what you're saying, so we're going to make that illegal. So it was not constitutional. Johnson, who burned the flag, was protected by the First Amendment, whereas O'Brien, who burned his draft card, was not. The draft card was against a law that wasn't targeted at speech, expression. The burning the flag was targeted at speech or expression.
Okay. So coming into some of the, you know, in today's world, we have things going on with book banning, cancel culture, and so on. Can you... What is the difference between book banning and cancel culture?
Okay, well, the first thing to keep on being reminded of is the Constitution only affects a relationship between the government and the people. So that particularly on private college campuses, if there is someone who was fired, or if there's a speaker who is withdrawn, that is by virtue of the quote private action of a private college. So the First Amendment isn't going to come into effect. But what other things might be is the mission of the university and the code of conduct of the university. Public universities might be a little different, not a ton, but might be a little different. But in a private college, they can pretty much make the rules as they want. In terms of book banning, there are Supreme Court cases with that. And book banning is you can't, local school boards and local communities have the right and the power of purchase. Like, they can decide what they're going to put into their libraries. You can't make these places buy every book. That doesn't make any sense. If they would, they should all buy my book, but that's a different story. but you can't make them, you know, they have budgets that they have to abide by. So you can't compel them to buy certain books. However, once they purchase them, they can't then start pulling them off the shelves because they don't like what they say. They can pull them off the shelves if they're age inappropriate or for other reasons. But just because they happen to be talking in a positive way about the LGBTQ community or talk about racism and how it has infected our society, you can't pull them out based on those reasons. So and that's usually done by a school board or by local officials. So that's going to be a government-based action. So that's some of the difference.
Okay. So in freedom of speech, we have a differentiation between advocacy and incitement. Mm. How do we balance that? How do we distinguish between the two?
Well, that's a good question. One should ask that to former President Trump. it's difficult. And it's more and more difficult in this age of the internet. So the distinction between advocacy and incitement was finally decided by the Supreme Court in the 1960s in the Brandenburg case. And what the court said was advocacy is protected, incitement is not. And incitement is very specific. It has to be intended. Intend to incite illegal activities of the crowd. It has to be in the moment, like it can't be contingent on an event in the future, and it has to be sort of an incendiary situation where there's not time for it, so that groupthink takes hold. So incitement again has to be intended and has to be in the moment, and the words have to be particularly crafted to incite. Little bit sounds like January 6th on the ellipse, but that would yet be a different story. One of the things that we find now that makes this whole, particularly the concept of immediacy, is on the internet, because things are not immediate on the internet. That we can plant things and they can grow and they can boil over time. So this concept of creating in a situation which incites the crowd can actually happen not immediately but over time. So it feels like maybe this incitement test is a little old. It also affects what happened on January 6th and with President Trump. These people who came to the ellipse and who rioted at the Capitol, they came ready to rumble for sure. I mean, all President Trump had to say is the election was stolen and they were going to go. So did he incite it? Did he add an additional match to the flame? If the flame was already ongoing, is he responsible for that incitement? We've since learned he also knew that they were armed, which changes the dynamic a little bit. Knowing that they were armed, now can he be targeted with inciting the crowd? So the concept is that you can advocate that the election was stolen and we ought to do something about it. What you can't do is say we got to go hang our vice president and destroy the people who are representing our government.
Okay, so now we're talking freedom of speech, inciting and advocating. Now, what about putting a gag order on someone? Are you taking away their freedom of speech?
Well, we have a lot of amendments. We have 27 amendments, but what we're really talking about, what you're talking about, is two of the amendments: the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial and the First Amendment right to free speech. And oftentimes, even within the First Amendment, we have this that we have to make a balance between rights and liberties. You know, my right and your liberty. In this situation, we have the requirement that we really need to have a viable criminal justice system where people are not intimidated in terms of being a witness, where juries are not contaminated. At the same time, we have people who are being prosecuted. They have a right to say the prosecution is unfair. In this particular situation with President Trump, he's running to be president again. He is a politician, and he certainly has a right to talk about the fact that he thinks that these prosecutions are unfair and that they are targeted against him. What he doesn't have a right to do is intimidate. what he doesn't have a right to do is to taint the jury pool. And so there's a balance there. And that's what these gag orders are trying to do. It's not easy, particularly with a man like him. It's not easy to do, but that's what's going on here, is that he's not being gagged about his opinion. He's being gagged about the way he is expressing his opinion. You know, go ahead and say this is unfair and that you are being targeted and this is all political. But by targeting court workers and prosecutors and intimidating witnesses, that is going to undermine our Sixth Amendment right, as well as just a societal right to a working and fair criminal justice system.
Well, we have also different types of speech. We have defamation, we have hate speech, we have political speech. Are those all corrected? Are they, you know, is there a differentiation between them?
Absolutely. First of all, political speech is given the highest protection in the land. And it makes sense, right? That if we don't have free and open debate and discussion, having a working democracy is really difficult. However, there can sometimes be limitations. You can't have a political rally in the middle of the interstate, right? That, you know, that's going to affect the safety and the ability of people to move about. So you can have what we call time, place, and manner restrictions. Go ahead and have it at the Capitol grounds, but you can't have it on the interstate that goes around Washington, D.C. So you can have time, place, and manner restrictions. Nonetheless, restrictions on political speech really do have, the default option is that we're going to protect the speech, and we have to find reasons. Usually they have to be compelling reasons that the government can articulate and can craft regulations that are narrowly targeted to those articulated reasons. Defamation is yet a different thing. Defamation is about when you are hurting, injuring somebody's reputation. And there we make a distinction between who is the target of the defamation. And the thing that we most focus on is public officials and public figures who really have the ability to have a wide range of effect on society, our psychology and our society. And in order for them to say, you know, my reputation was harmed by what you said, they have to prove that the person doing the harm, the person defaming them, did so knowing what they're saying was not true, or with reckless disregard of whether it was true, really couldn't care less, really didn't do the slightest bit of research on it, and just sort of spouted this thing because they felt like it. Of course, the guy's name from the Newtown, who is just escaping me, but the guy who really sort of defamed all the parents in Newtown, just sort of was reckless disregard of the truth. He wasn't telling the truth, and he knew it, and he was still defaming these parents and the deaths of their children. Then comes hate speech, which is always so difficult. Hate speech by itself is protected by the First Amendment. I've had conversations in my classroom with students of color, which is always really very difficult. I'm a white woman, obviously. And when students of color would say hate speech needs to be unprotected, I'm really not in much of a position to say, oh, it should be, right? They're the ones who've been targeted in a way I have not been. So we would talk about it, and we would talk about what hate speech is and what it does and how to regulate it. We do have two theories. Three theories about ways to regulate hate speech. One is this concept of true threats, speech that is terrorizing, that puts people in fear of their life or liberty. That's usually couched in hate speech. That can be punished. That can be regulated. These things called fighting words, where you are provoking someone almost as if you had a fist in front of their face, and that's also couched often in hate speech. Harassment is really almost more behavioral. It creates an impossible situation for someone to go on with their life. Those sorts of hate speech, which are almost behavioral in nature, can be regulated. As to the rest of it, it's hard. On college campuses, it's private college campuses. It's easier in the classroom. It's easier out in the public forum where someone's spewing hate and vitriol. It's that sort of stuff that goes into the marketplace of ideas. And the theory is the best way to destroy it is with counter speech. It's the theory. Doesn't always work so well.
No, it doesn't, because a lot of times people are so angry and so adamant about what they think and what they're saying and what they've heard that their ears are closed to anything else. So most people will just go, okay, and walk away instead of having something called a discussion.
Right.
A real discussion.
Right. But how do we define hate speech? You and I might define it one way. I can assure you that those people who marched on Charlottesville are going to define it different ways. So totally. How do we define and therefore regulate hate speech?
Very difficult.
It is. It is. And that's ultimately where we would come, even in these classes of mine, is, you know, yeah, it's painful. And yeah, it's terrible. And it's harmful.
Very harmful. Look what's going on today in the last month.
Of course. Yes.
It's exceedingly harmful. And no, there is no way of defining it, because for everyone, it's a little bit different.
Right. Private colleges, however, are taking the reins and they are dismissing certain groups, and they can. Public colleges are going to have a hard time of it because they represent the government. And remember, the First Amendment is about the relationship between the government and the people, whether people are individuals or corporations. But so that the private colleges are having have more power to regulate this. And they're doing exactly that. And in an effort to keep their campuses safe and to try to maintain an atmosphere that encourages debate and discussion and not vitriol.
Well, talking about government power and whether it be private corporations or individual, I want to go back to something that happened, I believe it was the 70s. It was a great movie, The Post, about the Pentagon Papers. I'm sure most people have seen the movie, Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, I mean. But there's a huge story behind that and how freedom of speech really got involved in that. So can you give us a little summary of what took place for those who haven't seen the movie or don't really know about the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam War?
It reads like a spy novel. That is such an interesting story. And it's basically the First Amendment part of it. It's about censorship. What happened was Daniel Ellsberg was an employee of the Rand Corporation. And he actually helped draft these papers that were called the Pentagon Papers about the war in Vietnam and the truth of the realities and the truth of the war in Vietnam. And I think there were only a handful of copies. I was going to say seven, but I think I might be wrong. It was less than a dozen copies that were created because it was really, really so secretive. He became really uncomfortable with what he had learned and wanted the information out to the public and believed the public should have it. And he tried to get it through the government, and he finally ended up getting to the New York Times reporter to give all this information, and there was duplicity even on that end, and the book really goes through it. It's really such a fascinating story. But ultimately, the New York Times started to print these papers, these Pentagon papers, again, about what the truth was about the Vietnam War, which was A, we were losing, where there was no way for us to win, that people were dying unnecessarily, that, you know, the protests really actually were appropriate and had the truth behind them. And so the New York Times started to publish these papers. And the government went to the courts and tried to get what's called an injunction, which is saying you can't publish these anymore. And it's called a prior restraint, which is censorship. And a prior restraint, censorship means there's no speech at all. All there is silence. You can imagine with a First Amendment that gives us the freedom of speech, this concept of silence is just an anathema. It just shouldn't happen. So in New York, we had this injunction. But it was only against the New York Times. So the Post also got the movie about the Post is the Post's part of it. The Post also got the Pentagon Papers. And while the New York Times is enjoined, cannot publish, the New York Post starts publishing. And so the government, again, goes to now a different court. And that court says, yeah, go ahead and publish. You can, you know, this is about censorship. Censorship isn't okay. So it can be published in it can be published in D.C. in a D.C. paper, but not in the New York Times. So ultimately, within days, within weeks, it goes up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court effectively said, censorship's not okay. Government, you have not, you know, you said you have a compelling reason, which is national security, but you haven't done a good job proving it, that narrow tailoring thing. You haven't done a good job proving it. And so we're going to let this go forward and we're going to let these be published. Indeed, it was. There seems to be some indication that, in fact, there were secrets that were leaked that did affect things. It also probably pushed the Vietnam War towards a swifter end. So ultimately, it was a good thing.
So you just mentioned the Supreme Court. We've mentioned it a couple of times before. And their decisions on the First Amendment really shape the way future words and actions are you know, taken. So where do you see things going?
This is such a conservative court that it's hard to say. I can see this court trying to maybe limit speech on hate speech. I think the thing that's really going to come up to them is this horror that they've created in the abortion field, that we have some states that are literally trying to stop people from talking about abortion and giving information about where to get abortions in states where it is legal. And we have precedent that says that you can't, that's information, number one, it's political speak, number two. We had a situation where people were trying to counsel women who were trying to get an abortion. And the Supreme Court said this was political speech and ultimately, in most circumstances, gave its approval for those sidewalk counselors to counsel women who were getting abortion. How that can be switched now and say you can't speak about abortion or tell someone how to get an abortion in a state where it is legal is going to be interesting. I think they're going to find themselves in a space they didn't expect to be in, with, again, a lot of precedent that really doesn't support the ability to censor people, to create a prior restraint. We have the issue of traveling, too, but that's a different thing. So I think that's really going to be something they're talking about. They certainly have recently put our freedom of religion ahead of our freedom of speech, and that people do not have to serve the LGBTQ community. I shouldn't say that. If someone can serve them hamburgers, but they can't if it's something that is an individualized artistic endeavor. A person is not required to do that if they are religiously inclined against that. And this was a situation where a woman set up websites, these wedding websites, and she refused to create websites for LGBTQ couples. Again, had she been serving hamburgers, she wouldn't have been able to refuse people. But this was a creative endeavor, it was a speech endeavor on her part, a communicative, expressive endeavor on her part. And the court said you can't compel someone to speak in a way that it is the antithesis of what they believe. You just can't compel them to speak.
So we've covered so much today. What would you like somebody to take away from our discussion and from reading your book?
That's actually really easy for me. And I have this in the last part of my the last pages of my book. The First Amendment is sort of a how-to, you know, and it creates boundaries and lack of boundaries for our way to speak. It is not a moral compass. It does not tell us how to act civilly. It does not tell us to act morally. We have to infuse that into the First Amendment, and particularly at this time right now, thinking about the fact that constitutional speech is bounded, it's sort of boundless. Moral speech is not. Moral speech is much, much smaller. If we can sort of infuse our constitution, the concept of constitutionality with morality in our heads, not necessarily legally, because I don't think that that's appropriate, but to infuse morality into our speech, that's what I would like to see. And that's what I would like to be the moral of the story.
Lynn, where can people find out more about you?
I have a website, lynngreenkey.com, and you can find my book on that website. It's also available on Amazon and in Barnes & Noble and any place that you buy books. It's also available on Audible. You can listen to the book.
And the book is When Freedom Speaks. Lynn, thank you so much for being with me here today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.